This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I am so happy today to welcome one of my favorite authors, because he wrote one of my favorite series. And it is wonderful to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Edwin Hill. And the name of his new book is Who to Believe. But I just love him. He is an award-winning author, and his series, which features a Harvard librarian, Hester Thursby, is one of my favorites. There aren't enough books in that series, Edwin. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Patsy. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you know, I love any books about libraries, librarians, and of course book lovers, because, you know, people are going around lately. There was an article about me calling me the last of the red hot book lovers. I don't want to be the last of the red hot book lovers. I want to turn everyone into a book lover. And if they read this book, Who to Believe, they will become book lovers, because this is so good. You know, I know Amazon lets people rate it 5 stars, but they should have this additional one little thing they could add to it, is a moon at the end. So if it is a book that keeps you up at night, they should let you put a moon on it. So it'd be 5 stars plus a moon, because when somebody starts this book, they're not going to stop.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm very proud of this book, and I very much appreciate your words.
Well, you should be. It's so beautifully complex and so beautifully written. It's a challenge to write a book from one point of view. You know, so many people, when they write their first book, they write it in first person because, well, they can just do I. You know, we have certain politicians who can always use the term I, and it comes with writers too. But, you know, and then they add another dimension and they go to third person. But to take 6 people and write it from their point of view, that is a challenge.
Thank you. Yeah, so this novel is called Who to Believe. And it's the story is set in a small town on the south coast of Massachusetts. It's a fictional town, but it's based on, I sort of pulled different things from a few different towns to sort of create this fictional town. And it starts out with a murder. It starts out with the murder of a local restaurateur named Laurel Thibodeau, who's asphyxiated in her own home. And as often happens in these cases, the suspicion immediately falls on her husband and business partner. He has gambling debts, and he recently took out a large life insurance policy on his wife. And he also has a rock-solid alibi. You learn all of this on the very first page, so I'm not giving anything away. But what the story really takes off when a group of friends get together to celebrate the birthday of one of them. And everyone, this is a small town, and everyone at the party has an opinion on what happened to Laurel, who killed Laurel. I'm not giving anything away, I don't think, but not all 6 of those people make it through to the end of the night. And then so what I did with this novel is I was really inspired by a movie called Rashomon. I was also inspired by the TV series The Affair, which ran about 10 years ago on Showtime. And I told the story from each of the participants at the party. I told their perspective on what happens at the party and the aftermath of the party. And so you do go over some of the same material a couple of times, but each time you see it, it opens up a different window on the story. You learn more about the story.
Oh, you do. And of course, when a book like this, I love psychological suspense thrillers. When they're good, they're really good. And this one, there's so much planning that people don't realize. There's a lot of planning that has to go into creating a plot as complex and as nuanced as this one.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of playing. It depends on the novel I'm working on. There's this concept of a pantser or a plotter. A pantser just kind of rides by the seat of their pants, and a plotter really plots everything out. I am more of a pantser in general when I write, but with this book, I really had to plan things out because I had to know who was revealing what when, and it all had to fit together in a way that would make sense to the reader, but also was satisfying to the reader, so that if you learn something about, you know, if you learn something about an incident, if you learn something new about that incident, it's making that incident more interesting. And so that was really fun and really challenging. And I was still surprised by the writing process.
And you did it so beautifully. I knew what is wonderful when I get a book like this and I suspend everything else. I go into the suspense because I want to have this absolute pure joy of the reveal. And here we have really sort of an onion reveal, a little bit here, a little bit here, and then woo! The whole concept I thought was so great. I love that you started with the psychologist. I always like to be that fly on the wall to one of these. I've never gone to therapy, although I think several people might have suggested could have used it. I have a. There was a woman in a club I belong to. I think she would have suggested it. But I like that concept of what's going on in that, you know, dialogue. And that I thought that starting with that chapter. Now, you had to make these decisions, which point of view you were going to start with.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You know, the character. So the novel starts through the point of view of a guy named Farley Drake. And he's a psychiatrist who has a nasty habit of getting too close to his clients. And so Farley, I felt like I had to start with his story because he had this view into this community that was very unique to his experience. So he's a therapist. And the big what if, you know, when you're writing, you're like, what if, what if, what if? And then you sort of answer the question for yourself. And so the big what if that I had for Farley was, what's it like to be a therapist in a very small community, and what do you do when you see your clients out in the real world? And I thought to myself, let's make this community very small so that there is very little chance that he doesn't see his clients out in the real world, and then let's see how ethically he treats those incidences. And so I decided to make him very unethical, which you'll learn very quickly as you read the novel, and so then his story sort of went from there.
And of course, I think some people might have started with of course you have the different characters, the Unitarian minister, you have the police, but everything, you know, from the police chief, many people would have started with him perhaps because, you know, there's the murder, but I thought your choice was perfect. And then each of them, it's like they say, you know, when you have a crime, all the witnesses come out with a different version. He was tall, he was short, he was fat, he was thin, you know. And so we have that here in a very complex way because you really, when we talk about like Easter eggs, all right, a lot of very fancy Easter eggs in this book.
One of the fun things about writing this book was kind of some of the Easter eggs I had planned from the beginning, and those ones I don't really want to talk about because they're so integral to the plot. But one of the Easter eggs that was really fun to develop as I was going on along was this birthday cake. So the whole novel centers around one of the characters is turning 40. So her name is Alice Stone, and she is very intent on having a birthday cake at her party, and she wants her husband to supply that birthday cake. And she doesn't want to tell him. She sort of arranged everything for the birthday party except for the cake, but she doesn't want to tell him that it should be a carrot cake and that carrot cake should have walnuts and raisins in it because that's her favorite cake. And so so throughout the novel, the cake sort of comes back into the story. And it changes, like the reader's view of the cake and sort of what happens with the cake changes as the novel progresses. And that was something that I wasn't planning at all when I started. I just kind of, you know, I was writing and there was a birthday and there had to be a cake. So I was like, okay, there's a cake. And so it was kind of fun to write it and have it sort of change meaning. And it winds up, what is really fun with those types of objects in the story is that it helps the reader understand the character of the character who's interacting with the object. So we first see the cake through, we actually first see the cake through Farley's point of view, and he has no emotional attachment to the cake. But then we see the cake through Alice's point of view, and she has a lot of emotional attachment to it. And then we see the cake through a couple of other different characters, and it sort of changes as the novel progresses. So that was what was fun about writing this novel in this format.
Well, it works so perfectly. You know, for my listeners who are just readers, now I say just readers, the most important aspect of the book world, the wonderful, wonderful readers who might not understand what an Easter egg is. Can you explain that?
Oh, sure. An Easter egg is just a little surprise in the novel. It's like something that resonates for you when you see it, when it suddenly appears. An Easter egg, actually, there are a couple of different things. You can also have Easter eggs that sort of call to earlier books. So, like, I've written 5 books, and so I didn't put that many Easter eggs in this one. So, like, an Easter egg might be something that where, like, Hester Thursby, who's my the protagonist of my series, she might show up late in the novel, and that would be an Easter egg. So there is one Easter egg in this novel because this character named Brock London, who's a state detective, he shows up as the state detective for this murder, and he was in the last book as well.
I love it. Well, of course, I recognize that, you know, things like that. And I got such a kick out of it. And I was thinking to myself, oh, he is having fun. When I talk about the joy on paper, just coming out with the idea, then working it into this, the shape that you've worked it into. And I know you've had wonderful reviews and everybody, you know, and really, you know, fine authors have recognized the talent that went into this book.
Oh yeah, people are so generous. I mean, this has been very sad. I did have so much fun writing this book. I sort of had the vision for it, and it was challenging. I'm not going to lie. Like, writing a novel like this is challenging, and keeping all of the different threads and keeping track of all of the different threads was the really challenging part. But I had so much fun writing it. And I want my number one goal is always that the reader have a fun time reading my books. And I hope that they have fun reading this. I hope they have fun sort of seeing the puzzle reveal itself. And another really fun thing about this book is that there isn't a tradition. There is a police chief and there is a state detective, but there isn't a traditional detective in this. And the person who plays the role of the detective in this novel is the reader, because the reader is the one. At the end of the novel, the only character who knows what happened is the reader, because they pull all these threads together and they figure out how they all fit together.
Well, that's why I think it's such a fun novel. Really making the reader the one who's going to see everything, and the reader starts to realize, my goodness, all these other people are saying this and this and this, and they have to put it together. I think that's what will keep people up and wanting to tell Amazon, let me add a moon to this review. Let me add a moon. The guy kept me up. I had to have a cup of coffee. I needed a cup of hot chocolate and a piece of toast, which I went for the hot chocolate and piece of toast, like somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, not, you know, I get a lot of books. I read a lot, you know, so not, I don't think I could survive if every book kept me up all night.
Probably not.
But I was happy with this one, because I think you just hit the right tone. It's so exciting when I come across a book like this. And I know that when people read this one, they will. I want to really tell them they have to go back and they have to read. I think the series with Hester, I love it. And I think that, you know, there's, what, 3 books in that series only, right?
And there are 3 books in that series, but I have an idea for a 4th one. And I would love to return to Hester. She's a really great character.
Good. And of course, you throw in, you know, a Harvard librarian. I like that concept. It's a great series. So you have so much going for you. I think with this book, it's almost like, I feel almost like a breakout. Like, my gosh, you know, it is so good. People just, you have to read this book.
Oh, thank you. Well, you are making my day. The book came out today. And you kind of, you know, you work on a novel for so long, and you just kind of sit by yourself with it for, you know, like every day you get up and you kind of look at the blank page and you're like, you know, is this going to turn into something? And so it's really satisfying, you know, when I hear from readers, when I hear from people in the media like you, when there is a positive response, it really makes your day, I have to say. So, and this book has been getting some good press. It got starred reviews in a couple of the trades. And like you mentioned, some really fabulous authors blurbed it. Lou Burney did, and Liv Constantine, and Alex Segarra. So all really terrific authors.
Oh, it deserves all the accolades it can get, because it is wonderful. It really is. And what I love, when I was at, I checked you out on the bio thing that they send me and everything, and I got such a kick out of one of the things I got such a kick out of that they mention that of course, well, no, first I want to mention your main characters, not main character, the dead character, the dead woman, what is her name?
Laurel Thibodeau.
I got such a kick out of that, because when I was young, I really taught myself to read, and I didn't know, I was mispronouncing so many things. It was so funny. When I went to England, I was 21 years old when I moved to England, and I was mispronouncing so many names. And and so I know I was
we
thinking,
all do that in the UK.
Exactly. I was thinking everybody's going to be saying Thibodeau, and I was, because when I was, well, I was, I think, 12 or 13 when I started reading Camus. And I thought Camus was a great writer. I was, you know, I think it was years. I think it was like 16 before I discovered it's Camus.
Oh, gosh. Yes. I love words like that. A word that I learned just through reading is hyperbole. And even now, when I just said the word right now to you, I had to stop myself for a split second and remind myself to say hyperbole instead of hyperbole.
No, isn't it wonderful? I love it. That's why I always tell readers, don't worry if a word comes along and you're not sure of it. You know, later on, of course, nowadays, if you have Kindle, you can look it up. But it's so much fun. I think all of those recollections, like when I went to England and I wanted to go to Slough. I wanted to go so...
Oh, sure. Yep.
You know, and you know, Slough. Slow, yes. So, but also, I love that you mentioned in your thingamajiggy about yourself that you know exactly where you were when you read Agatha Christie's Seven Dials Mystery.
Oh, yes. So the very first time, when I sort of got, I always loved crime novels. I read Hardy Boys, I read The Famous Five and The Three Investigators, but my first adult novel was The Seven Dials Mystery by Agatha Christie. And my parents bought me that. We used to go on these month-long family camping trips. So I was in the back of our yellow Bronco, and we stopped at a gas station. And we were on our way to see Mount Rushmore. And at gas stations used to have these like metal racks where you could buy paperbacks. So they bought me a copy of The Seven Dials Mystery, which is one of Agatha Christie's early novels. So it's set at a manor house. And, you know, it's very
chimneys.
Fancy.
There's chimneys.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so anyway, I devoured the book. I thought it was just like so good, and I loved the puzzle. I loved the way it all fit together. And then I just spent 35 years teaching myself how to do that myself until I finally got my own novel published.
Well, you've come a long way. But the funny thing is, I know exactly where I was when I read that mystery. I was at 815 O'Farrell Street, San Francisco.
And no way.
I remember it so clearly because, I mean, this is like one of those golden threads. my girlfriend, and I had just arrived in San Francisco, and it was one of the books I had taken for the trip, you know, the Greyhound bus trip in those days. And I was reading that book, and my girlfriend wanted to go to this party where I think she was initiated into the drug world. I was reading Agatha Christie, and I said, no, I can't go. It was actually a life-changing thing for me, because she changed, and I kept reading books.
Oh, my God, how amazing. Are you still in touch with her or no?
I just love it. I just love it. So I was thrilled, and you certainly learned your lesson with all that reading. So it's so exciting when a writer gets to this point. And now, of course, for you, actually, this year, it's nice now. This came out after the pandemic and after. So hopefully you can get out there and do some events. One of the things you mentioned, of course, you got some nice blurbs. Now, do you remember your very first check, the first time you got paid for a piece of writing?
Oh, sure. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but it sure felt special, I have to say. And, you know, it feels good to do something that you really believe in and something that you enjoy doing. And then to get some compensation for it, it's awesome.
Well, you know, I've been working with some writers who, 9 of my listeners did NaNoWriMo this year. And so they have, you know, come to me over the year as they were preparing for it, asking me for questions and, you know, what to do and how to prepare. And one of the things is, as I'm thinking about this point of view, most of them had no idea. I think they all, except for one, did it in first person, wrote their book in first person. But the complexity of doing six different point of views, I think, is really so wonderful and really a testament to your talent that you could pull it off so beautifully. So
thank you.
It's just, I think it's fantastic. One thing I told somebody once, and this is years ago, I said, when I started the show and somebody didn't understand point of view, what is it? You know, sometimes these terms, they don't understand what they're, it's like voice. What's my voice? I don't know. I don't have a voice. I thought my voice was, you know, they don't understand it. And so I did mention that at Thanksgiving dinner, after Thanksgiving dinner, when everybody goes home, ask them each to write a little story about what happened at Thanksgiving dinner. And you'll see that none of them will say the same thing. So this is how you can start envisioning point of view.
That's exactly right. This I will say that if you're writing your first novel, I would not recommend this, what I just did with this. it is very complex, and I think maybe one or two points of view is probably a better model to start with. I really wanted to challenge myself with this book, and that's why I gave myself the 6 points of view. So, and it was very complex. But when you're first writing a novel, like when I was first writing my first novel, which is called Little Comfort, I did NaNoWriMo to get it started, and it took me about 2.5 years to finish the manuscript, not because I didn't know the story, but mostly because I was teaching myself how to actually write a novel, which is like a skill that you have to develop. So, shockingly enough, it doesn't just come out like you watch on the movies, and there'll be a character sitting in front of a computer or a typewriter, and they just sort of write the book during a montage.
Yeah, and then they're overnight New York Times bestselling author the next
day. That's exactly right. Yeah,
right. It is a craft. It is a craft. I like to think of it as the Leroy Jethro Gibbs craft. He knows how to sand. He knows what to do, not what to do, how to make work on his craft over and over until he comes out with a beautiful boat at the end. And you have certainly come out with a gorgeous boat at the end in this book called Who to Believe. And it is really, when they advertise it as a twisting domestic thriller, and let's throw in a psychologist there and be a fly on the wall to the psychiatrist. I love it. I love that whole premise. Again, Edwin Hill, I think you're fantastic, and I'm so happy that you joined me today. And you probably have a website you want people to go to.
Oh, sure. You can come to my website. It's at Edwin, E-D-W-I-N, dash, don't forget the dash, ill.com. And I always love to hear from readers. So if people want to drop me a note, I would love to hear from them.
Exactly. Everybody, and get out there, read this book, and do a lovely, lovely Amazon review, do a review. They won't let you put a moon yet, but you might just mention that. in the review. I stayed up all night. Thank you so much for joining me today, Edwin. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you, and it was a pure joy to stay up
Thank you,
and
Patsy.
Have my hot chocolate and a piece of cinnamon toast at 2 o'clock in the morning because of you.
Thank you, Patsy. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Okay. We're going to have he's wonderful. This book is so much. It's just fun. I loved it. I loved it. Okay. We're going to have a few commercials, and then we're going to be back. And I have my next guest, very important guest, and I'm looking forward to talking to him, Severin Ashkenazi.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my next guest, and I'm so honored to welcome to Joy on Paper Severin Ashkenazi, and the name of his book is Swords of the Vatican, Reflections of a Witness to Evil. Hello, Severin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm so honored to have you on the program today. There's so much I want to talk to you about, you know, in these very difficult times. We would tend to probably to start talking about recent and current events, but I want to give you enough time to explain to you, my listeners, the premise for the book and what you mean when you use the term Swords of the Vatican. And for me, it's a very important book. I was in Poland for the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I was traveling around Poland at that time and other times. I was actually in Lublin. So I am familiar with what went on in those days. And of course, you were born in Poland, or what is now, I don't know what it's called now. But let's set the background a little bit for you. just tell my listeners about where you came from, and then we'll talk about Swords of the Vatican.
All right, since we have a little time, I will try to condensate a lot of the things that I wrote. Where am I from? I'm from a small town in what was Poland. It is Ukraine today, not far from the one of the largest cities of the area that used to be called Lemberg. Now it is called Lviv in Ukrainian. These areas have changed hands over the past few centuries from being Poland, then Russia, then Austria, then Poland, then the Soviet Union, then Greater Germany, then Poland again today. Hey, I was born in 1936. I represent four generations, if you will, of this time, of this past century, and probably two more, because my parents always spoke of the events of the 1900s at home. They didn't quite understand what happened, although highly educated. They couldn't believe that the Germans, such highly civilized people, would do what they did. 1937, in Poland, we are a very comfortable family. Our Polish is perfect. My first language is French, because my mother insisted that we should, my brother and I should speak French. She did. French was sort of the lingua franca of the time, where it was a diplomatic language and probably rivaled, if not exceeded, English as an international language. My father, who was a chemist, a food chemist and a mathematician, was offered by one of the great chocolatiers of Poland to go to the United States, open a factory. He was a Talmudist as well, and the Talmud says if you have a comfortable life, do not necessarily seek a more comfortable life. And my parents turned down Mr. Piasecki, I believe Adam Piasecki, and 2 years later we had nowhere to go. The Russians crossed the frontier. We were thrown out of our apartment, moved into another town. A year and a half later, the Germans crossed the frontier. We ended up in the ghetto. And out of 8,500 Jews who lived in this town, 139 survived, and we were the only family unit. So this is your rapid background of where I came from, what I could know, what I knew. Later, I spent some time in France, and in Los Angeles, I went to UCLA and advanced to the PhD candidacy in romance literature. So then I entered the business world and built buildings and hotels. Not forgetting that I was a Jew and that charity was something that I should practice on as large a scale as I possibly could. So that it brings us to today. Patsy, it brings us to today. What would you like to know that I may share with you, where I may have greater knowledge than most?
Well, you know, as I said, I want still to talk to you about current events, but let's go back to the Swords of the Vatican and talk about where you came out with when you decided to write this book, and it's sort of a understanding, trying to understand the development, I guess, of Judaism or Jewish people, what it means. Why did you title your book Swords of the Vatican?
I wanted to tell people, I wanted to tell the readers, I wanted to tell my family, my children, what brought us to the many moments of the tragedy that the Jews went through. It certainly happened in earnest with the birth of Christianity. So I explained what Christianity is. I explained that Christianity, it was an invention of a Jew, who later became known as Saint Paul. His Jewish name was Shaul of Tarsus, from a religious Jewish family. There was discontent in Rome at that time about the many different religions. And he just threw one more, which was the combination of a prominent religion at the time called Mithraism and Judaism. These are really the two prominent religions of Rome, plus dozens and dozens of other pagan gods and the religions. But these are the two major ones. He combined them, and it was only afforded Jews for the first 60 or 80 years. It was not the religion that was going to be offered to pagans. Now, the church covered a lot of that information over a period of centuries, because Mithraism is roughly Christianity, but 700 years earlier. And I'm sure your listeners will be interested in digging further. Let me just simply say that the sun was the god. He's too powerful to come help the people on earth, his people. He has a love affair with a day, with a goddess, has a son called Mithra. Since he's born surrounded by shepherds, he grows up to be intelligent and smart and performs miracles. He's born on December 25. He has 12 disciples. He dies for the sins of the people. 3 days after he dies, he is resurrected and flies to his father. Before he flies, you have a ceremony exactly like Easter, at which he says, "Those who do not drink of my blood or eat of my flesh will not be saved." Exactly Christianity. The only problem with it is that it's 700 years before Christ.
Knowing as the Christians did at that time, knowing that Jesus was a Jew, when did this happen? This horrific anti-Semitism that started so far back, and then we wake up today in the year, sometimes I can't believe what year it is, and we are now in 2024, and it's like nothing has changed.
A lot has changed, most of it to the worse, for us Jews. You ask me, how did it happen? The Roman Empire chose this new religion called Christianity over the other religions, and by the 4th century Christian era, they started persecuting other religions in order to establish Christianity as the sole religion. Not only was Judaism persecuted, but so were all the other religions, including Mithraism, in order to make room for Catholicism, which within it had a great deal of anti-Semitism, which already existed 2-3 centuries before Christ. One of the problems why the Jews were denigrated were because they were religious and they were cheaper slaves than others. You took a Jewish slave, he only wanted to work 6 days a week. You could kill him on Shabbat, he wasn't going to work. It's only later that the Jewish establishment decided that the Jewish slaves should be bought back by communities, and therefore the value of the Jewish slave became larger. But anti-Semitism already existed in Greece 300 years before Christ. It just got worse during the Roman times, and then the Jews were the easy scapegoats for every reason. Bad season, too much rain, fault of the Jews. Earthquake, fault of the Jews. Diseases, it's the Jews.
We know the Vatican really codified anti-Semitism. They went out of their way to make sure that people would be anti-Semitic or would blame the Jews. But when you look at it, it is so irritating. It makes me so angry to think about it, because I don't know. I know that at one point you said, I think in an interview or perhaps in an article, something about if women were in charge of the world might be a better place. But somehow, somewhere along the line, people don't understand the basic concept of Judaism. You know, there were problems, but once it was sort of set where we wanted to be, whether it was the Jewish concept of not taking an egg in front of a bird, of not destroying trees, all of these things that were Jewish principles, and keeping Shabbat and not working on Shabbat, and actually the whole idea of treating women special because of it. What went wrong? What went wrong here? And why are we in this mess?
Well, apparently men need to blame men. And we were easy targets. Jews were a highly divided people, as we are today. Divided people without leadership. There were 10 different kinds of Jews at the beginning of the Christian era. They were easily divided. Today you have Jews divided into conservative, into reform, into reconstructionist, the ultra-Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox, the agnostic, atheist. We are so divided that we do not have a single voice that we would listen to. Nothing has changed. The division of the Jewish people led the Jewish people to the disaster. And here we are. And you look at Israel, if they would not have had half of the country for months marching in the streets, protesting a few dishonest politicians' plans to change the Supreme Court, maybe they would have had the time to look at what was happening on the other side of Gaza, in Gaza. They didn't. Now that quieted down. God knows what else is waiting for us. But we are a very divided people. Christianity is a very organized religion. You have Vatican, you have the Pope, he guides his people, and people listen to him. and they have been very cruel, and they have committed acts criminal acts for the last 2,000 years that can hardly be described, not only against the Jews.
And yet we do have wonderful Christians who have supported Israel, who have warned Israel about the dangers of what we were facing, and who know that, Israel was facing all of these challenges. So it's so difficult to understand. Well, I suppose it comes down, as you talk about in your book, and it's a fascinating book. It's called Swords of the Vatican, Reflections of a Witness to Evil. And we are facing evil all around the world, all around the globe. There's not, who would have thought just, 5 years ago, that there would be a war in the Ukraine again after, as you said, it changed hands so many times over the years, back and forth. This group conquered it, back and forth. And each time getting more and more evil as they did it, as the horrific cruelty that is going on in the Ukraine today. It's hard to understand.
It is also a religious war. There are a lot of Catholics in Ukraine and the surrounding areas of Belarus, of course, Poland. Many of the Ukrainians, and most of the Russians, are Orthodox Catholics, and they have their own issues to resolve. But may I ask you the question, are you Jewish?
Yes. That's why now, I was in Poland. I was in Lublin. I walked the streets of the ghettos there. Where it's now like a ghost town of the ghetto. And
I
was there.
You went to Majdanek?
Yes.
You went to Majdanek. Well, I have a home, an ancestral home, and I spend a portion of my time near Lublin, in a small town called Kazimierzdol. I know the area very well, and wherever health permits I go and spend some time there. But I'm going to ask you a question, and maybe your listeners would reflect upon it. What is a Jew? What makes a Jew? Because if we are not able to answer that question, how would we be able to explain to others who we are? And why would we be able to demand a place in the sun for the Jewish people? But if we do not know who we are, and the Gentiles do not know who we are, then there is really no conversation. The one side says you killed Jesus Christ, probably never existed. We are responsible for all the ills of the world. We should be killed unless we become Christian.
Well, I have very, very little time, and I would actually love to have you back if you would like to come back. But to me, being a Jew is being a Yiddish mama. It's loving your children so much that you don't want them. People will say, well, why didn't Jews want to, go into wars, or why were so many conscientious objectors? And it's a Yiddish mama. We want our children to be close to us. We want them to live a wonderful life, a educated life, a smart life, a kind life, very much a kind life. Maimonides is part of our life. And that's what we are. And we are not mamas who take $25,000 if our kid is strapped with a bomb and sent into a crowd to blow themselves up. That's evil. So I think if anything, a Jewish mama is the really the foundation for
I must. I must tell you, it's one explanation. Frankly, one that I haven't heard yet, your explanation. But if you gave me time, I think I could bring you to a conclusion that would be simpler and more complicated than yours. But well, we have no time.
We don't have time, but I do want to mention, one thing. In your book, at the very back of your book, you have a photo of yourself. And you have a photo of yourself standing, and you say the floors were polished. They were so clean. And that is sort of what I think of as a Yiddish mama who takes care of her family, takes care of her. It's like what's happening today with the people who are rioting, with the people who are stealing, with the people who are breaking into businesses and walking out with handfuls of clothes. Where are their mamas? And where are the mamas of the Russians who are going into the Ukraine and committing atrocities? Where are their mamas? Even in Israel today, we have Jewish mamas who want to be good. And we did not, nobody understands that in Israel, back all the way back in 47, the Jews were so good compared to everybody else, any other country in history. It's very difficult to comprehend this.
Yes. Well, you have an explanation. The likely explanation is that a Jewish philosopher 2,000 years ago, Flavius Josephus, wrote that the Jewish central effort at preoccupation is to educate their children.
That's it?
That was 2,000 years ago. He must have written it as a historian, a well-known historian, one of the great historians of antiquity. Really of modernity, if you will, because it was the beginning of Christianity, to say that he had to have a perspective of hundreds and hundreds of years to come to that conclusion. So if our central preoccupation is educating the children, if that is really something very, very important for us, and our children have become the intellectual.
I'm running out of time. I'm sorry. The name of the book is Swords of the Vatican, Reflections of a Witness to Evil. It's by Severin Ashkenazi. It's available online. People, it is a great book to read. It will open your eyes in so many ways. I'm so honored that you are on the program today. And if you like, you can come back anytime, okay?
Anytime you invite me, I will be back.
And we'll talk more about the concept of the Yiddish mama who wants to educate her kids and keep them safe.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Okay, well, I've run out of time. It's hard to understand. I will have him back. I hope that he can come back and we'll talk more about, I don't know, people. We have to change somewhere along the line. We have to become better people. Okay, thank you very much for joining me today. It's Joy on Paper, and you can see more on my website, radio-joyonpaper. And let's say something nice to somebody today, and I will say
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
Listen.
It's time for the Tuesday edition of Canada Calling, on air and streaming.